Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what can we learn from the making of FDR's New Deal? We'll compare the politics of past and present. Then, scholars note that the world is waging fewer wars, but that the wars that are waged are more brutal and intractable. How far have we come in the science of making peace? The U.S. financial crisis has led many progressives to invoke the New Deal as a potential model with which to fundamentally reform the flaws in the U.S. system. And while the modern circumstances have similarities to the crisis that brought the New Deal, they're also quite different. Still, what can we learn from the program that fundamentally reshaped the country? Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Michael Hiltzig joins us now. His new book, The New Deal, A Modern History, explores the politics and personalities that made the New Deal. Welcome back, Michael Hiltzig. It's great to have you back with us here.
It's nice to be back.
There are some significant similarities, but there are also significant differences when you compare the two time periods. What would you say the most important similarities and differences are?
Certainly, the causes of the Depression, of the Great Depression, and the causes of the Great Recession that we're still living through were very similar. They were both preceded by this period of just frenzied, imprudent investment in assets, periods in which the banks and the financial industry were just over the line, beyond the pale in terms of the risk they were taking and that they imposed on the economy. Housing crisis, there was one in the 20s, and a foreclosure crisis just as there is today. The economic conditions are a lot more similar than I think even today we realize. Now, in terms of differences, I think the political context is quite different in ways that maybe today's citizens don't really understand. Today, you have two parties, arguably both are very homogeneous in terms of their ideology. Certainly, the Republican Party all marches in lockstep with really an extremist wing. In the 1930s, you didn't have this sort of intransigence politically. Both parties, the Republicans and Democrats, had very strong conservative wings and very strong progressive wings. In fact, the leading progressive in the U.S. Senate was Hiram Johnson, senator from California. He had run for vice president for the Progressive Party, the Bull Moose Party, with Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. Well, he was a Republican. And on the Democratic side, the harshest opposition that Franklin Roosevelt faced in getting the New Deal across came from members of his own party, the Southern Democrats, Democratic senators from the Solid South. These are the same people who ended up as Dixiecrats in 1948 and ran Strom Thurmond for president. So Roosevelt really had to juggle both parties. He had supporters and opponents in both. But he didn't have this dyed-in-the-wool intransigence to face that President Obama does.
Political scientists are saying that the polarization is really the greatest in 150 years. Although I saw similarities in the rhetoric from your book, it seems like it's much darker today, or uglier maybe is the word.
Well, it's certainly gotten more extreme, although it was very extreme during the 1930s. And as you said, some of the rhetoric is identical. Roosevelt was accused of being a socialist and a radical. Some of the New Dealers who were his closest advisors, were accused of being communists and socialists and radicals. Roosevelt's ethnic background was challenged. All these sorts of things also happened. But I don't think you did have this extreme polarization in the 1930s, in part because the economic conditions had been so severe and so dark and had gone on for so long that there was much more willingness to just get behind Roosevelt. And even though he didn't have all the answers, and he said he didn't have all the answers, he really showed a willingness to try anything. And for years into the New Deal, the entire country was behind him. He had opposition from big business, opposition from conservatives, of course. But that was really a minority opposition right up until about 1935, 1936.
And in terms of the financial conditions, it seems a little different today in the multinational corporation. With globalization and even more concentration, the power structures may be different. Would you say that's true?
In the 1930s, as now, you did have income inequality, you had inequality of wealth, and you had a concentration of power. Back then, I think you have that even more so today. This concentration of wealth was a real concern, not only for many of the New Dealers, but for many of the thinkers who gave life to the New Dealers. Louis Brandeis, who by the time Roosevelt became president was a justice of the Supreme Court, had been a lawyer in Boston, and he had written a book about the concentration of size and wealth in business. That book had been published in the teens. Adolph Burley, who was one of the original members of Roosevelt's Brain Trust, who was an advisor to Roosevelt even before he became president, also was very, very skeptical about concentration of wealth in business. And it was Burley's notion that you had these 600 entities that were controlling an enormous amount of wealth, and he really wanted to help break that up.
Speaking of Burley, his take on individualism was really important. Can you talk about how his take was distinct from what had been in the American rhetoric before?
That's right. Burley was a wunderkind. He had been a young graduate of Harvard, I think. He had really made his name as a very young man. And just before Roosevelt's inauguration, Burley had written a memo to FDR, which amounted to a critique of the rugged individualism ethos, Herbert Hoover, and going back to Calvin Coolidge. What Burley said is that there really is no individualism because all of these individuals who were lionized theoretically by Republicans, the average man struggling to make his way on his own, well, they were not individuals. They were really at the beck and call of big business and the powers that be. And that Hoover's idea of individualism was not individualism at all. It was really just an excuse for manipulating the great mass of people.
He was part of the Brain Trust, right?
He was one of the original members of the Brain Trust.
There was some rancor in that Brain Trust.
Well, you know, there was this trend in which you see it over and over again that people who started working for FDR early on, even before the 1932 convention that nominated him for president, you can detect, if you read their memoirs and their works, this great devotion and even love for FDR. And often, in almost every case, it begins to fade. And that's a testament to the fact that Roosevelt was a very enigmatic leader. He liked to be all things to all people. And you can see this evolution in which people who went to work for him started working for an FDR of their imagination. And he fed into that. But as reality set in and they worked longer and longer, they began to discover that when Roosevelt faced some political emergency or political exigency, he could shift very quickly and very subtly. And all of a sudden, they were working for a different Franklin Roosevelt. And although they still loved him as a man, they got to be very skeptical of what he was doing and suspicious as to whether he was really following the course that he told them he was. So there was this evolution. So you had a number of members of the Brain Trust who went on into the administration, played very important roles, at least for the first few years. And then you had a few who worked through the campaign, got Roosevelt elected, and then went on to other things. Burley, in fact, went into business. And others did other things. Ray Moley, who was the original member of the Brain Trust, ended up running a magazine that became Newsweek.
This wanting to be all things to all people does sound a little bit like our current president. There's been a huge letdown in the progressive community about what President Obama has put forth that seemed to parallel some of the left during the New Deal. They really wanted him to revolutionize the system, and he didn't do that. He was completely a compromiser. Do you see that as an important parallel?
Well, it is a very important parallel. In fact, I think it's very instructive for progressives today, and we can argue endlessly about whether Obama is too much of a compromiser or just enough, or if he shouldn't compromise at all. I don't think we're really going to have an answer to that until we can look at it in a rearview mirror. But I think the reaction among progressives to Roosevelt's course is something that we ought to keep in mind because we've all lived through this before, or at least the country has lived through it. To progressives, Roosevelt looked like the answer when he was elected in 1932 and took office in 1933. But progressives became very disaffected with him, just as they are with Obama, because at heart, Roosevelt was a pragmatist. He knew what he wanted to achieve, and he was a very supple politician, and he did have to walk a line between conservatives and liberals. Think about this, that the Securities Act of 1934, this is the act that gave us all sorts of transparency and corporate disclosures, gave us the Securities and Exchange Commission, which really, I think, arguably to this day, is still the premier, the gold standard of financial regulation, which is not to say it's perfect. When the final draft was presented on Capitol Hill by the administration, it was viewed by progressives as a total giveaway to Wall Street. And the New Republic, which at that time was a leading progressive voice, the way the New Republic greeted this bill was Wall Street should treat Roosevelt with gratitude. because essentially they thought he's given Wall Street everything it wanted. That's not the way Wall Street saw it, by the way. Wall Street thought that this was going to be a radical, unprecedented intrusion of government into business. But to progressives, there was too much compromise. So I think it's hard to be president under any circumstances and not be a compromiser. We can argue, you know, on the ground as to whether it's too much or not enough or just enough.
One group that he did sell out was the African American.
That's right. In fact, I have a whole chapter in my book that's entitled The Most Forgotten Man. It's one of the ironies of the New Deal that it was during this period that this great coalition between black voters, especially urban black voters, and the Democratic Party was really forged. Of course, this is a coalition that has really lasted up to the present day. But the New Deal, its greatest failure was in racial equality and civil rights. And this was in part because of Roosevelt's perceived need to compromise. He saw that he had this really firm conservative bloc in Congress from the South. They threatened to filibuster any bill that had any sort of racial anti-discrimination component to it at all, including an anti-lynching bill, which was much needed and sponsored by the NAACP. And Roosevelt actually called in the leadership of the NAACP in 1935 or 1936 and said, look, I know you want this, but I can't make it an administration bill because the Southern senators will block everything else I want to do, and I don't think the country can afford that. Now, beyond that, a lot of the work relief programs that the New Deal instituted, they were placed in the hands of local managers at the state level, Mississippi, Georgia, Alabama, what have you. And those managers were essentially allowed to perpetuate racial discrimination in the distribution of jobs, in the distribution of grants, in setting wages between black and white workers. So if you really look at the record, you find that the New Deal really did fail in many fundamental ways its black constituents. In fact, to the point that when 1936 rolled around and the reelection campaign had started, the crisis, which was the house organ at that point of the NAACP, it had been founded by W.E.B. Du Bois, wrote an editorial about the four candidates running for president in 1936. Roosevelt, Alf Landon was the Republican, Norman Thomas was the socialist, and Earl Browder was the communist. And the editorialists for the NAACP said, you know, if you line up all these four candidates in terms of who would be best for the Negro American, to use their terminology at the time, we think number one would be Browder, followed by Norman Thomas, and then Roosevelt. But we want to be practical because we know that Browder and Thomas don't have a chance. So we think you should all vote for Franklin Roosevelt.
It seemed like the racism was pretty rampant in the administration, too. Some of the dialogue that you found. Talk about what it was like within the administration.
Well, there was a very interesting moment when Harold Ickes, who was Franklin Roosevelt's interior secretary and was in charge of a lot of the work relief programs, and he was a true liberal. He was a Republican. He came from Chicago, where he had been president of the Chicago chapter of the NAACP. When he took office in the cabinet, one of the first things he wanted to do was establish an office for racial anti-discrimination, for civil rights. And he did that. But the man he appointed to head that office was a white lawyer from the South. Now, that lawyer came to Ickes and said, you know, you've been talking about improving job prospects for the Negro American, and you want me to take a job that really should go to a Negro American. So why not appoint a distinguished black to this job? And Ickes said, you know, you can turn down the job, but I'm just going to appoint another white because that's what I need to make this office politically palatable. So he appointed the white lawyer, but the second in command of that office was Robert Weaver, who was a distinguished black lawyer from the South, who later on became the first black member of the cabinet. But that wasn't until LBJ appointed him in the 1960s. But it started Weaver on his career of public service, which was very distinguished. But you can see how hard it was for even true liberals to negotiate these hoary old concepts of black and white.
The other thing I thought was really important and special about your book, The New Deal, A Modern History, is that you really get kind of an inside view about how difficult policy change really is. If you were going to pick a vignette, what would you say are the most telling that help people understand the complications?
Probably the best example of all this is the difficult birth of Social Security. You look at Social Security today, this is the second book I've written that touches so deeply on this program, which really, if you look at the history, the most successful government program in American history. 54 million Americans today receive benefits from this. But it was not an easy thing to get done. To start off with, Social Security, initially, it was perceived that the most important component of it would be not old age pensions, but unemployment insurance. Federalize the unemployment system because the states were really tapped out. So that was really the number one goal of the original Social Security drafters. Now, at the time, there was a strong movement for old age pensions that came from the grassroots. Dr. Francis Everett Thompson, doctor from Long Beach, who had created this nationwide movement, the first movement of the elderly in American history, who were pushing for old age pensions. And in the 1934 election, the Townsend movement actually elected a number of congressmen. They were sort of the Tea Party of an opposite political stripe of their day. So old age pensions ended up on the front burner. But even up to a few weeks before the final bill was presented to Congress in January of 1935, Roosevelt himself was expressing real skepticism about whether old age pensions should be part of this bill. And he gave a speech and said, I'm not sure the time is right. Now, there was a furor among the social insurance lobby, and within a day, Roosevelt reversed himself. But he wasn't really sure about this. So Social Security, the bill gets passed, old age pensions really become the principal point. And the goal of the drafters, which was for universal coverage, all Americans were going to be members of this. Well, that was confounded by Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, who at the last minute, really this was after the bill had been submitted and it was now being debated in Congress, went before Congress. He had been a member of the committee that had drafted the bill. And he suddenly reversed himself on the stand before a congressional committee and said, you know, it's going to be too expensive for us. So I think you should cut it back. You should cover a lot fewer Americans and you should raise the payroll tax so that we don't have a deficit. And in fact, at that point, Congress took out coverage for domestic servants, for domestic staff, for farmers, and for many other categories. The first beneficiaries of Social Security, it was a fraction of the number that the original drafters wanted. And all those people were not actually added back into the system until the Eisenhower administration and afterwards. So you can see there were a lot of doubts. Nobody knew how much this was going to cost. Nobody really had gotten their arms around the idea of how much responsibility should the government, should we all have for our elderly and for our unemployed. That's a debate which unfortunately persists today, although to my mind, the debate was won many years ago, but you still hear these points being raised.
I think another aspect that today is different from that time of policymaking is the role of interest groups now in the level of engagement of certain interest groups. How much do you think the balance of interest groups and citizen groups mattered in passing a New Deal? And how would you say that plays out in today trying to rescue our financial situation?
Well, certainly the wealth and the power of many of these interest groups today is much greater than it was then. The Chamber of Commerce can get an entire party really marching to its drummer. It didn't have quite that success in the 1930s, but they did exist, and they did exert a lot of influence, and they were a constant thorn in Roosevelt's side. He was constantly battling with the Chamber of Commerce types, with the American Bankers Association. And by the way, they were fighting him with the same arguments. They were saying, oh, well, all of these New Deal regulations, they're creating uncertainty. And that's why business isn't investing. And it wasn't any more true then than it really is now. And of
course, did they call them job killers?
Well, I don't think they used that term. That's a fresh term. But that was the point they were making. They were saying, this is why business is not hiring. It's because businessmen are so uncertain. And of course, the regulations we're talking about back then were regulations on child labor and stock and bond trading and all the things that we now take for granted. So Roosevelt was constantly fighting them. Now, one of the points that I made in the book, I tried not to make it too explicitly because I think readers will understand it implicitly, is that Roosevelt had a much different approach, was much better, in fact, at defending his policies and expressing pride in what he had achieved than I think the White House or the Democrats in Congress are today. I mean, Roosevelt never backed down. And even when, say, in 1938, when he had to talk to the voters at fireside chat and say, look, we still have too much unemployment. We have more than we wanted. We have more than we thought we would have. Economic growth is still too slow, and we're going to need to do more. He would make sure that his listeners understood everything that he had achieved. He would say, look, your money in the bank is safe today. You don't have the fear about your homes and your farms being foreclosed that you had only a few short years ago. Your stock and bond trading is honest today because of our regulations, and we have done all that. We haven't gone all the way, but this is what we've achieved. We're not going back to the Depression of 1932 or 1929. We've beaten that. He also was a very strong, very explicit defender of the concept of government action. He would say, look, you know, there's talk out there that we should send Congress home, but I don't believe in that. I believe that Congress is not an intrusion into our democratic process, because a democratic legislature can never intrude in a democratic country, and that's what we have. And he understood that even inaction is a form of action.
It is, indeed.
And inaction was a form of action that had prevailed during the Hoover administration. And he said, that's negative action, and that's not what we're going to do. We're going to work to fix things. We're not going to overturn the system, but we are going to really address the abuses that we have here.
A couple of other things. One is the economic crisis of that day. Walter Lippmann, you mentioned, called it a good crisis because it was actually an opportunity. Do you think today we have a good crisis, or do we have what he called a bad crisis?
Well, I think we had a good crisis. I'm not sure we have taken advantage of it. And that was the point.
Lippmann, you might explain the right. Good crisis,
well,
bad crisis.
Right. The point Lippmann made was that there are good crises and bad crises. And a good crisis is one that you can fix and learn from fixing it. And he was specifically talking about the banking crisis of the time, when the banks had all closed. When Roosevelt took office, essentially America's banks were shut. So he declared a bank holiday. He kept them closed for another week or a week and a half, and then reopened them bit by bit and made sure the public understood that when the federal government reopened the bank, it was a sound bank, and they should have confidence and put their money back in and no longer have a run on the bank. But by the same token, although there were members of the New Deal and members of the Brain Trust who really wanted to take this opportunity to completely destroy and remake the American financial system, that wasn't going to be Roosevelt's approach. And he marginalized those people. And as I said, he tried to address the abuses. Now, I think over the last few years, we had an opportunity to do that. We could have gotten much stronger regulation in the financial sector, much stronger regulation in the banks. And we didn't walk that last mile. We didn't make this crisis as good as we could have, to use Lippmann's terms. And I'm not sure that we defeated it. I'm not sure that the forces of good regulation and proper regulation really prevail, at least to the point that we've avoided the chance that we're going to have to go through this again too soon.
Well, perhaps that connects to another point you made, which is that the New Deal was really an evolution, and there was more than one really New Deal. So maybe it's all a work in progress.
Well, it was a work in progress then. I think it's a work in progress to this day. Historians sometimes talk about the New Deal and the Second New Deal, the Second New Deal having started sometime in 1935. My approach is really to look at it as a process that did evolve over time, in part because Roosevelt evolved. In fact, he got a lot more doctrinaire. He acquired a fair amount of hubris that I think helped end the New Deal, unfortunately. It did go through many stages, and it got more refined as we went on. The first 100 days when a new president takes office. For Franklin Roosevelt, whose 100 days were the first 100 days that we've ever talked about, that was really a period of just putting out fires and addressing real crises and doing it as fast and in a quick and dirty way. You could almost argue that the rest of the New Deal was an extended effort to do everything they had done in the 100 days, but do it right. They had a Securities Act during the 100 days. They had to have a new one in 1934 to fix it. They had new banking laws. They remade the Federal Reserve a couple of times. But even since then, we continued to try to remake the New Deal. I think the principle that's the beating heart of the New Deal, which is that we have a shared responsibility, and the instrument of that shared responsibility is the federal government, I think that persists. And despite all the rhetoric you hear about too much government and government's too big, I think most Americans really do understand that and really do agree with it, that when the chips are down, you really do turn to the federal government to help you, you know, to bring disaster relief, unemployment relief, work relief, all these things that were really created as concepts by the New Deal. But we continue to debate how much of that is right, how to deliver it, how can we do it better, how much should we build. Look, America built more during the New Deal than it ever had before or since. To this day, we drive, we fly out of airports built during the New Deal. We drive on its highways. We use the sewer systems that were built then. We use the bridges, and we teach and learn in school buildings that were built by otherwise unemployed men and women of that era. We're still debating how much of that should we do today. So the principle is sound. The instrumentality is still under debate, and the lessons constantly have to be learned and relearned and relearned. And I hope that's the value of this book, is to remind people that these were lessons that were first learned in the 1930s, and that that created a principle of action that, that really is still maybe even more relevant today than it ever has been before.
Perfect place to end. Michael Hiltzik, the new book, The New Deal, A Modern History. Thank you for always enlightening us on these issues.
Well, thank you.
When we come back, scholars say the world is waging fewer wars. What are we learning about peace and peacemaking? And can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? Stay tuned.
Heal the brokenhearted, wipe away the tears. Heal the soldiers' wounds and the children's fear. Heal the shattered lives and tattered family ties. Oh, let the war be done. Let the peace be won right now. Let the peace be won right now.
This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. What have we learned from past conflicts and peace processes, and can we use that to end the brutal wars that are still raging? Three experts join us now. Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. George Lopez was previously Chair and Professor in Peace Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization in the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Scholar Circle. We have, according to some scholars, seen that the world is engaged in fewer wars today, but we still have a lot of conflict. First of all, is it true that we're getting less violent as a humanity? And if so, what is working and what is not working? George Lopez?
Sure. Thanks so much. I think in terms of the recent data, it's certainly the case that there is less formal war. There's less internal war than there was 15 years ago. But one of the things we find is that when war is still ongoing in places like the Congo or Syria, it's much more intense, brutal, and elongated than we've had before. It's also the case that the degree of fallback after peace agreements try to take hold for 2 or 3 years has increased over time. So we have some good news and we have some bad news. In terms of what's worked, it's very clear that we learn a lot about what makes a solid peace agreement work and all the dynamics that must go into it maybe as many as 13 or 14 primary factors, particularly external support, the need for economic development plans, the need for full participation quickly in a national reconciliation process. But it's also the case that with the Syrias and the Congos, there isn't the full international commitment and resources to try to get behind the peace process and empower local people the way it works in some other conflicts.
Irvin Staub.
Well, it's true that in some sense violence has diminished, but at the same time, we have such intense high-level violence in a lot of places that it is almost complacent to talk about decrease of violence. Some of those are what George mentioned. The Congo, he didn't mention the Sudan, where there has been ongoing violence of an intense kind. So it's very problematic, and we must focus on how we can prevent it. I think that for me, somebody who is concerned with how we can go at this from different perspectives, but I'm rooted in psychology, one of the issues is how we can develop more positive attitudes by groups of people towards other groups whom they live with, whom they are in the same society with. And we can't only talk about what it is that we need to accomplish. We also need to talk about how we can do that. And we know from a lot of research that creating joint projects where people work together for shared goals is very important. It's important with kids in schools. It's important with groups in societies. Another really important thing from my perspective is to create positive visions that include everybody in society. Usually when there is violence within a society by one group against another, a destructive vision or ideology develops. What it is that we need to create for our group in order to enhance the well-being or protect the security of our group. And that can be very varied. It can be nationalism. It can even be the vision of social equality, which the Khmer Rouge propagated. But usually, in the cases of such visions, some group is identified as an enemy that stands in the way, and then often it leads to an attempt to destroy that group. So to create positive visions that includes everybody in that society and brings people together so that they can work together for shared goals is extremely important. I also want to mention the issue of healing from past victimization. People, individuals, and groups who are victimized see the world as dangerous, and they very easily lash out when they are threatened again, believing that they need to protect themselves by force, and they become perpetrators in the process. And we have some ideas of how to create healing processes. I also want to mention the issue of justice in these societies. You know, people who have felt victimized or been victimized usually deeply yearn for acknowledgement of what was done to them and some kind of justice. And this can go on for a long time. You know, in Argentina, after the disappearances, everybody received amnesty. And then 20 years later, there was a new justice process because there was so much unhappiness and unrest in society about the unfinished business of victimization and injustice. So there are a few others that are very important. I will mention just two things finally. One of them is the issue of generating what I call active bystandership. Often leaders don't do what they should do. They also remain passive bystanders in relation to what happens in other societies. So citizens have to become involved and propagate actions by their leaders. And the earlier countries respond to what happens in other countries, the less need there will be for force, for violence, for military action. And finally, in all societies, there is the issue of child rearing. How to raise children so that they become what I call inclusively caring, meaning caring not only about people in their own group, but also about other people, and morally courageous enough that they can take action.
And perhaps then they don't elect leaders that are warmongers in democratic societies. So Irvin Staub has just been laying out the societal level things. Now, Noren Ripson, you've looked at things from the state level. What do we see there?
Well, my research focuses on building peace between regional rivals, a particular kind of rivalry. And what I've found typically is that when regional rivalries resolve themselves, it's not because of societal pressures. In the first instance, it's because of states, that is, state pressures, state interests, whether they be alternative threats, more pressing threats internationally, whether it be pressure from great powers, particularly in an era of hegemony where there's one state that's far more powerful than others, the hegemon, or whether it's simply state survival interests, regime survival interests, and the perpetuation of the power positions of the leaders in power. And then, ultimately, afterwards, when it comes to peacemaking, afterwards, after an agreement is reached, then if the agreement is socialized and society is brought on board, you can have a successful agreement, whereas when society is not brought on board afterwards, you tend not to have a very successful agreement. Now, on the general question that you posed, I think that right now we are in a moment where the evidence is incontrovertible that warfare, interstate warfare, has declined, particularly in the developed world. The question is whether this represents a trend or whether this is a particular moment in time, whether it's a moment in time because of the presence of a liberal international hegemon in the United States, which has no challengers. I mean, there are other states that may be dissatisfied with the United States and its leadership, but they don't have the capacity at this point to represent significant challengers to it. So whether the question is whether the reason why we're in a moment of greater peace now is because of American hegemony, whether it's because of the spread of liberal values and liberal norms worldwide, whether it's because of globalization and the spread of economic benefits, whether it's because of the destructive capacity of war, as some scholars suggest as well, that makes war at least more difficult to contemplate because of the costs, is unclear at this point. But the question is whether this is simply a moment, and in the event of, say, the rise of great power rivalries again, or, say, in the event of some kind of ecological disaster or even economic crisis beyond what we have right now, where states start calculating in very different terms, perhaps in 20, 30, or 40 years, we might not be in that moment of greater cooperation. So there's really a question about whether this is an enduring trend or whether this is simply a moment in time, like we've had other moments throughout history where conflict was suppressed or reduced for a period of time, but then reemerged.
It's interesting that you bring up the hegemon factor. The last war, interstate war, that turned into a disaster was perpetrated by the hegemon, the U.S., in Iraq. But you also brought up a couple of other interesting points, like the environment, like what's coming with climate change. Will people handle this in a peaceful manner? One other thing that Irvin mentioned was about the creating a peace and reconciliation process. Perhaps we should look at that also. George Lopez, let's go back to you now, and let's look at some of these big questions. One conflict that has not been mentioned that seems to be on the verge of a genocide is the Central African Republic. Let's look at this. Let's look at Syria, the Congo, Sudan, and think in terms of what we know now, what needs to be done to prevent bloodshed.
Yeah, it's a great question. Thank you. And I think when you look at Congo, CAR, and Syria, we're talking about places where all the mechanisms I want to mention actually never got a chance to take hold, partly because of internal anarchy or because of dictatorial rule. And I think one of the things that it's often difficult to convince public audiences and policymakers alike of is the number of cases that turned not into large-scale violence, because what we were able to do was to put in place the preventative or violence-mitigating mechanisms that we've learned in the peace-building enterprise over the last two decades. Specifically, for example, if you look at some of the things that were going on during peace processes in Colombia, in Ireland, more in Burma, to a certain extent in Tunisia in the midst of the Arab Spring, what we had was lots of international agencies that do training in everything from security sector reform to police monitoring and retraining to civil society engagement training people in the values of conflict resolution, the kind of inclusiveness that Irvin talked about at every level, from schools through civic organizations and the like, training people without very much experience in democracy in their country to the virtues of broad-scale participation and national dialogues. All of these kinds of approaches have been used since the terrible wars in the Balkans in the early 90s taught us that you really need to engage civil society in order to prevent a war of all against all. We've not been able to do that in a Syria or a CAR, but in so many other places we have been. And these are interesting human technologies, human institutions, ways in which we learn that the technologies of peace run the gamut from simple training in mediation and negotiation for community leaders all the way through how you reform the police and the armed forces to be both more inclusive but to understand a very, very different role for themselves in building a new national order. You know, you mentioned Mr. Mandela, of course, is that one of his powers was the ability to call people to an identity and a purpose beyond their self and their existing trained prejudices. And we can do that in a number of ways. And there's so many international and domestic agencies that do that so well.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudin, and we're talking about what we've learned about preventing and ending violent conflict. In terms of the international hegemon now, Noren Ripsman, I want to go back to you. The U.S. has tried and failed, or maybe hasn't tried hard enough, to bring peace into regions like the Middle East, for example, Israel, Palestine. How vital is it that the hegemon, the United States, play a role there? And if it's not there, what could happen?
Several issues that you raise and that I want to address that were raised before. But first of all, I think it's essential. In order to bring peace between rival societies, states and quasi-state actors have to have key interests that allow them or that persuade them that despite societal hostility, and there's intense societal hostility and antipathy, that they need to take risks and make significant concessions in order to reach an agreement. Now, to begin with, that means that hegemonic engagement is essential or very important. It could happen without it, but it's very important to try to create incentives, both pressure and opportunities for these states in question. But beyond that, the hegemon can't drive the process. The hegemon has to look, and other third-party actors, not simply the hegemon, great powers, international institutions, have to look for opportune moments. They have to look for moments when conflicts appear ripe for resolution. And any efforts they expend at times when conflict isn't ripe for resolution, when there aren't, say, competing threats that are of greater concern to one or both of the parties in question, or when one or both of the parties in question perceives that it has economic interests that may topple the regime, that may threaten the hold on power, and therefore may make an unpopular peace treaty essential for their own purposes, then it may not be an opportune time for outside forces, including the hegemon, to gain leverage over a particular case. One thing I want to address, you know, with regard to this is that I study what I'd like to joke are the easy cases, intense rivalries between regional states. I joke that they're easy because they're not easy, but they're a lot easier than some of the types of cases you've been talking about, where you have either poorly institutionalized states, non-state actors, such as, for example, the Palestinian Authority, or where you have societies with, in the absence of any kind of state institution or top-down hierarchy. And under those circumstances, it becomes a lot more difficult to overcome societal animus. What you need is a strong state in order to be able to reach a decision and carry a decision and then socialize a decision over time. Absent that, societal engagement is great over time, but it's a much longer-term process. And so trying to engage in making peace by engaging society may take, you're talking decades rather than short-term solutions, and a lot of people can lose their lives in the interim, whereas with a state to be able to take what may be a very unpopular decision to make a compromise and make concessions can actually do that in a shorter period of time, and there's willingness.
It sounds like you're arguing is that statehood would matter for Palestine. Is that what you're saying?
state building may be very helpful. This is a particularly inopportune moment right now. I think the circumstances were far better earlier in the new millennium because you actually had an entity that wasn't divided on the Palestinian side. And then the idea of building state capacity to be able to reach concessions would have been very appropriate. Now that it's divided, it's not really clear that you'd actually have a unified state that it would be interested in and able to be able to reach a peace agreement. So the moment there may actually have evaporated in the last, well, 7-8 years.
I know it's probably Irvin's turn, but I'd want to disagree with that. I think the NGOs that have been working on the ground and the backroom dialogue of a number of groups with Hamas may in fact lead to an opportunity that we didn't know existed 2 or 3 years ago, including with good participation of Israeli agencies. So I'll just leave it there with that.
I know Irvin Staub's also been engaged in that region. Irvin?
I have some things to say about a number of things that my colleagues have said. So let me start with some of that and then go to Israel-Palestine. One of these is that the role of external parties is extremely important, and they have to work with internal parties because it's internal parties that are in a position to make a change. But from my perspective, it's not only a hegemon like the U.S. now that can exert very substantial influence. Other countries can also, especially countries that have some kind of a relationship to the people in power in a particular situation. Unfortunately, people who have that kind of a relationship often, because of that relationship, remain silent and they don't exert influence. But if other parties can work with these external parties so that they will exert influence, like, for example, the Arab countries in relation to Israel-Palestine, that can make a tremendous difference. Also, and among other things, the media can be very powerful in creating change. So, for example, in Macedonia, where there was violence between groups there, a number of journalists from different ethnic groups came together, went and interviewed people belonging to these different ethnic groups, and wrote stories about their lives, lives that were extremely similar. And then they published these stories in the newspapers of each of the ethnic group. And that kind of thing can humanize the other, show similarities amongst us. Also, talking about external internal collaboration, various NGOs from the outside have prepared ideas for a new constitution in Macedonia. And some of these ideas were included in this new constitution that addressed some of the rights issues and contributed to peace. One other issue, we were talking about interests, and economic interests and various interests, and the parties' interests have to lead them to take some kind of action. Unfortunately, ideology often trumps interests. If you look at Israel-Palestine, you could say that creating peace has there been in the interest of both parties for a very long time. But on the Israeli part, for example, the ideology of a greater Israel and the power of a minority that has exerted strong influence in behalf of that ideology was one of the things that has contributed to continuing conflict and violence. And on the Palestinian part, really, it's also an ideology, a vision of how to live life, and that is that there should be a world there, a Middle East there, without Israel. And that has exerted continuing interest. And who could argue with the notion that it has been in the interest of the Palestinians to make peace there? Now, the problem in terms of external bystanders has been that while the U.S. has made efforts at various times to try to promote peace, when it came to really using the power or the influence of the United States, we blinked again and again. So, for example, George Bush the First, when he tried to make loans to Israel contingent that they start building settlements, there was such a pushback that he gave up on it and he didn't engage sufficiently. And I think that there has to be a kind of a determination on the part of external parties who are in a position to exert real influence. If you are a real friend of that country, you are going to use that influence. Now, that means that you are presumptuous. You assume that you know what is better for them. But it is hard to argue that creating peace with the Israelis and Palestinians would have been better for them.
There's, of course, the realities here at home, the role of these interest groups that are attached to ethnic groups that are attached to these countries, the lobbying that occurs.
If I may just add that, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if we here in the United States, especially because we do have such power and potentially such moral authority, we lived in a country where we had presidents who decided, I am going to do the right thing, going to then take the political consequences. Often, if they are successful with the right thing, the political consequences would be beneficial. But very often, they blink. I went when there was bombing by Serbs in Bosnia. I talked to a member of the U.S. National Security Council and said, why doesn't President Clinton do something? And he said, well, the president cannot do anything because people out there in Podunk would not support it. So here is the supposedly most powerful man in the world who, at least one of his associates, said he cannot do anything because it would not be popular. The willingness to take action that is right and could have real benefit that is unpopular would be really wonderful.
George Lopez, let's go back to you now. You've looked at the United Nations and its role. What has been successful and what has been unsuccessful? How would you say it's doing, and what has worked? What has not worked?
Well, I think it speaks to the different expertises of those of us you've had on just now, and that I think one could take a look at the UN Security Council and say big power politics operates, and you wind up intervening in certain kinds of ways in Libya and not in Syria, and this is what happens when you deal at the big power level. But I tend to have a lot more confidence in groups like the United Nations Mediation Unit and their various panels of experts who've gone into various conflict zones and analyzed who are the people making money on the gun running, where the porousness of the border is, and who are the civil society actors that might be strengthened and stood up by various agencies in order to create conditions of less violence as soon as possible and create more space for political dialogue. And I think that's the UN that doesn't make the front page headlines, and it's not the one that involves veto power of the big politics, but it really is the way that institutions within the secretariat and associate agencies really work on the ground. And their ability to bring regional actors together, to bring civil society and militaries together in some kind of national dialogue, often aided by institutions like my own, the U.S. Institute of Peace, I think has really made a difference. In every single case, no. But in many more of the cases, we've had reduced violence than we did a decade ago.
And in terms of some of the programs, does it work?
Well, it depends on what else it's tied to. When you intervene in a conflict to separate warring actors and anarchy has broken out, you're intervening at the worst possible time and with only the military tool left to you. Most of us would prefer the work of whether nation states or international organizations to occur much lower in the conflict cycle when you have enough hate speech and you have enough early outbreaks of violence that you know the direction it's going to go, and it begs for more action sooner at various levels rather than only one action left to you 6 months from now, which is a military intervention. The presence of military troops most especially protect innocent civilians from being slaughtered. They create zones of protection and maybe even a space where political dynamics of diplomacy might work and bring an end to militant forces ruling the ground and create conditions for more nations being now more focused on where we need to go with better political and economic development to create a more stable peace.
Noren Ripsman.
First of all, in response to Irving Staub, I think ideology matters, but the point is that when interests are such that leaders are attuned to the need to resolve a conflict, then ideology may take a back seat. So how do you explain the Saudi peace initiative towards Israel? I explain that in terms of the increasing threat that they perceive from Iran. And as a result, they're more receptive to trying to resolve a lesser conflict in order to deal with a more pressing adversary from their point of view. So ideology, I don't think, is an insuperable obstacle if the conditions are right for some kind of peacemaking. The other thing I would say is that engagement of society can actually be counterproductive at times prior to the resolution of a conflict. If you're dealing with non-democratic states, you may actually have a choice of engaging society democratization and spreading liberal cooperative values on one hand or stability on the other. And a lot of the peace resolutions, the peace treaties that I studied, actually are peace treaties with states that are objectionable from a point of view of a Western liberal point of view. But if they got the sense that the international community was trying to go above their heads and democratize or spread liberal values as part of the settlement and not accept the state, you never actually would have gotten, say, an Israeli-Egyptian treaty or an Israeli-Jordanian treaty. And so sometimes we have to choose between, unfortunately, between our values of stability and peace on one hand or liberal values and democratization on another hand.
Of course, the proper approach depends on the exact circumstances. So there has to be an analysis of what is happening and what is the issues and attitudes of the parties involved. All other things equal, I think that the kinds of things that George described that is happening now is of very great importance, because if we act early enough and if we act at those levels, that means that later violence can be prevented. And so early prevention is a significant issue. Some time back, the international community was not interested in addressing smoke when there was no fire. So it's very good that we are moving towards an approach that concerns itself with what's happening at an early point and taking early action. But the kind of action that is required depends on the exact circumstances. And sometimes interests will trump ideology. But very often, unfortunately, in the cases of very great violence, ideology leads the way.
What a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, all three of you, Irvin Staub, George Lopez, and Noren Ripsman.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Irvin Staub is Emeritus Professor of Psychology at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and award-winning author of The Psychology of Good and Evil, Why Children, Adults, and Groups Help and Harm Others, and Overcoming Evil, Genocide, Violent Conflict, and Terrorism. George Lopez is the Vice President and Director of the Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding at the U.S. Institute of Peace and the co-editor of Peace and Security, The Next Generation, and Sanctions in the Search for Security. Noren Ripsman is a professor of political science at Concordia University. He is co-author of Globalization and the National Security State and the Challenge of Grand Strategy. That is it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests. An extra special thanks to Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, and Huatemoc Aileman, who produced this show each week, and to Sud Dongre, our webmaster and web host. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, you can go to scholarcircle.org or armudian.com or kpfk.org. You can also hear us on Stitcher, on iTunes. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.
Let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Let the wars be done. Live in peace as one.